Just a reminder, the context for this morning is we're going through the book of Revelation, and we've looked at chapters 1, 2, and 3. We last week went through chapter 4 and 5, and we're going to do chapter 4 and 5 again this week. I think it bears repeating because there is so much of what is spoken about in terms of the book of Revelation that is esoteric and only looks into the future, the far future, and plays games in a sense with all the different symbolisms and metaphors that there are through the vision. That we are looking at it from the perspective of John as he's imprisoned on Patmos. He is concerned about the churches, the seven churches that are mentioned in chapter 2 and 3. Who are all situated in what is now Western Turkey, Asia Minor in the old world of the Roman Empire. And they are literally in an oval shape inland from the Mediterranean and Adriatic Sea. So we're taking this from the perspective that John is caring pastorally. The vision that he has, he transmits to them in order that they may be discipled and strengthened to live well in the midst of a hostile world. And that's why it's important for us to look at Revelation, not in terms of trying to work out exactly who is the Antichrist. We'll come to that one of these days. But how does it help us to live faithfully in the midst of a broken and hostile world? And that's the context in which we're reading this. So Revelation 4 starts like this. After the letters to the churches, I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. And the voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and ruby. A rainbow that shone like an emerald encircled the throne. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were the 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder. In front of the throne, seven lamps were blazing. These are the seven spirits of God. And also in front of the throne, there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. And then we move on to chapter 5. Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept, because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw a lamb standing as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. Not a great place to stop reading, but let's stop there. I'm going to talk about worship this morning. I'm going to talk about what is the central feature after the vision of Jesus, which is the first vision. You come to the vision of a throne and what's happening, the door opened in heaven, and what's happening around the throne that John sees. And in a sense, we move from the initial vision in chapter 1, where it says, John says, "I was in the Spirit." Again, he says, it's repeated in chapter 4, verse 2, "I'm in the Spirit." He makes it clear that this is not something by the by. And the same trumpet voice that spoke to him in chapter 1 that gave the revelation of Christ as a central feature of all that's happening, again speaks to him with this vision. And the vision is of worship. And what we're looking at this morning is some of the things that come out of these two chapters that has to speak to us about the way that we live, in the way that we worship the living God. So, Christians worship. Just make a statement like this in the beginning. Christians worship with a conviction that Christ is in their midst. We're not here because we're hoping to invoke God to come. We're not here because we think that if we are good enough and we have enough of us that are holy, God might presence himself. We have absolute conviction that no matter what has happened, where we've been, what dirt has accumulated on our feet during the week, God is here. It doesn't mean he wants to leave us in those conditions, but basically, the primary underpinning thing of everything that we do when we get together is that God is present. He's here in all his majesty and power and glory. It often doesn't look like it. Because people, including ourselves, we look and we just see all the faces that we normally see. And we know that I've had a bad week, you've had a bad week, there's been great things in Sylvia's life or difficult things in Marnie's life. Who knows? We come with this whole hodgepodge of who we are, humanity. We bring it into this place. And that's what we see of each other. And we intersect in these moments when we come from all our different places into this place. The central thing about coming is the fact that Christ is in the middle, right in the center of everything that we do. Other people looking on, and if people walked in here from the outside who came as observers, would see a bunch of people from all different places on the planet, all singing some sort of unfamiliar songs. They would see us reading from an ancient book and then making comments about it. And then they would see us eating and drinking little bits of bread and wine as if it transformed us. They would come in and they would see only what is on the outside. There is a reality that is on the inside, and that's what we're looking at this morning, the sense of what is actually going on when we do what we do here week by week, when we do what we do at home with our kids. And I want to encourage you to read and pray and worship with your kids. What is actually going on in those moments? The first thing that I want to say, and here's the primary thing, is that worship centers us. The first thing in this vision in chapter 4, verse 1, is about a door open in heaven. A glimpse into what's going on. And the first thing that John sees is a throne. And that throne, if you go back into chapter 3, verse 21, was what the Laodiceans were promised, that they would be involved in the fullness of all that they'd had. Here we go. Chapter 3, verse 21, it says, "He who overcomes, I will grant to him to sit down with me on my throne, so as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." The throne is what? And let's exercise a bit of gray matter here this morning. I just basically want you to be engaged. The throne is a metaphor for power and authority and government. Rulership. When he speaks about throne, in your head, you're looking at sovereignty, you're looking at authority, you're looking at rulership, you're looking at the kingdom of God. When he sees the door open in heaven, he sees the king on his throne. He sees the king ruling. And the focus of what happens over the next while is if you want to actually be a disciple who understands and who knows what it is to walk faithfully and truly, then you have to have a vision of what it is to see the throne of God. You have to know what the kingdom is about. Because otherwise, you will not actually have your sense of balance and center. In Revelation alone, in these 22 chapters, the word throne, the Greek word throne, is used 17 times. And I'm not fond often of saying how many times a word is used, but the reason to say that is that what John is trying to say to these churches that are struggling with the same stuff that we're struggling with, is that you need to know where your center is, where your authority lies. Because if you don't, you're in trouble. Twice the word is used for other centers of authority, the satanic throne and the beast's throne in chapter 2 and chapter 16. But essentially, it's still talking about power. If we don't know where we are centered, if we don't know where the center of authority is, we will live eccentrically. Now, the thing that happens when we come to worship, and it may not look like it, because we've got so casual about coming into this place together. The thing about worship is that we choose, when we come here, we choose to say again, what we really are saying is that you are at the center. You are the pivot point of my universe. You are the authority. You are the ruler. You are the king. Whatever language you want to use, basically you're saying, I come before you. Now, a lot of people have difficulty with worship because worship is about who's in control. And we have been taught since we were knee-high to a grasshopper that we need to be independent, that we need to make our own choices, that we need to be able to stand on our own two feet, that we mustn't let anyone push us around. And the language is repetitive. It goes through school, it goes through life. Whether you're playing sport, it's all about asserting yourself and making sure no one tramples all over you. And we have been so conditioned to take control for ourselves that it's counterintuitive to worship, because when we come to worship, what we're saying is we acknowledge another center of authority. We acknowledge another person who rules over me. And Jesus says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And we know maybe intellectually all these things, but it's so deeply ingrained within us. And I think part of the trouble that people have with worship of any description is intuitively they know that they have to confront themselves and their own desire to make choices about what their life is going to look like. And choice is such a big deal in our society. I'm not going to go into that this morning, but the issue that is really at the heart of this is that we need again and again and again to confront the fact that we choose to put Jesus at the center. And in that sense, worship Jesus at the center, and it centers us. So it's like a double meaning here. And so the psalmist says, the Lord reigns, the King reigns on his throne. And when we worship, we are meeting at the center of who we are as a people. If we do not do that, you are then what is known as an eccentric Christian. In other words, you set yourself up. If you don't place Jesus at the center, this is the focal point, in a sense, of the whole thing this morning. That's why I'm going on about this. But if you do not put Jesus at the center of your existence, you become eccentric. And if you are not centered on who he is, we are people who then do our own thing. And what the greatest weakness of the church generally, and of Christians in particular, is that we pick and choose, like a smorgasbord, what we think we would like to be obedient to. If there is absolute authority vested in God, and he says to us, this is what I want you to do, and he lays it out clearly, then it's not up to us to say, I like this little bit about being kind, but I don't like this little bit about forgiving my enemies. I struggle a bit with this, but that I'm not. And we may not do it as crassly as that, but what we do most of the time is we pick and choose what things we will listen to and do in terms of the stuff that is set before us, in terms of God's kingdom and his rule. It's not a good image, and I toy with the idea of actually even using it, but where you have an absolute dictator, like in North Korea, it's at your peril that you do something that is not part of the established system. And if you don't lose your life, you certainly will be put away for the rest of it. And we play fast and loose with God in the sense of deciding what we will choose to do and not to do. And this is at the heart of what John is saying to the churches. He says, if you come to worship, you have to confront this issue of who's in control. Worship is about acknowledging that God is sovereign. He sits on the throne. And that it's current. It's not something that's in the future. It's right now. We don't choose what we obey. And so, a failure to worship, a failure to put Jesus at the center of life, means that we live in fits and starts, in spasms. Because if a thing has no center, then it has no circumference. There's no sense of being stable, of being focused, of being not blown around by every wind and doctrine, like Paul talks to Timothy. We are moved this way and that if we do not have a clear understanding of where the center is and who the center is in our lives. This was a perennial problem with Israel. And this is just a bit slight, sort of an illustrative thing in terms of an aside. Israel worshipped constantly in different places. Then they had the temple. But they were always being picked off by the Baal worshippers, who would set up a thing on a grove of trees on a hill and somewhere like that. There was this moving around of where the center of worship was. The temple came along. The Samaritan woman said to Jesus in chapter 4 of John, she says to him, where do you worship? We worship on this mountain. And she's trying, what she's saying is, where is the center of worship? And he says to her, in so many words, that I'm the center. So, I've labored this point quite extensively, I know, but the issue for me is that if you don't get this, you don't get the rest of the book. If you don't understand the centrality of Jesus as the authority figure in our lives, then not only does worship not make sense, but the rest of our faith doesn't make sense. Because what if you choose to do this and I choose to do that? There is no sense of coherence. There is no sense of family. And we can beg to differ on details of interpretation and stuff like that. But when it comes to the basic stuff, the general thing of what it is that God has called us to, what the kingdom looks like, we just got to get on and do it, guys. And I will say this. Worship is not only when we get together like this. It's not only when we sing. It is those things. Worship is the way we live our lives. Worship is the way that we conform ourselves to the image of the Father. That we not, as Paul says to the Roman church, don't be conformed by the things around you, by this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. I'm saying worship is when our minds are renewed to see that this is the issue. Here's another, just a little aside, is that There's a very, very powerful, pivotal passage in 1 Kings 8. And from verse 1 onwards, there's a whole sequence of events where they come and they want Samuel to anoint a king for them. And he's distraught. And then God says to Samuel, they haven't rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. If you want a spot at which Israel's troubles begin to be manifestly outworked, that's the point at which it happens. Yes, David was a great king, but then there was a whole series of events afterwards, because the focus of Israel becomes, it's lowered to a place where they're looking at a human being. They're looking at a man and saying, he's our king. They wanted what everybody else around them had. They wanted someone who would rule them, who they could actually tangibly deal with. And God was saying to them, you know what? I'm the king. And when you want another king, when you place something of more importance in your life than me, you do what Israel did. And I'm not going to go and say that every problem that you have and I have in my life is because we haven't made Jesus king of absolutely everything. But there is a sense in which when we place other forms of authority, other thrones are placed in place. That's what idolatry is. And we are built to worship. We are built to acknowledge. And when we place our trust or our faith or our allegiance somewhere else, whether it's nationality, whether it's ethnicity or language, or even our religious expression, when we have trust that is not focused on Jesus as the representation of the Father, we are falling into the biggest problem that we can face of idolatry. We're not even talking about things and consumerism and all that kind of stuff. Here is the central issue of these two chapters. Who's in charge? Who do we acknowledge? What does our life look like? What choices are we making? The second thing that worship does is that it gathers us. It's very easy for us when we are individuals. At the end of, is it Judges or Joshua? It just goes out of my head at the moment. But it says, every man did what was right in his own eyes. And we are very, very rapidly. My English, she are good.
Sorry.
We are rapidly approaching a place where everybody does what is right in their own eyes. Where everybody has their own sense of, if it feels good to me, then it must be right. There is no objective reality or truth. And so you have all these issues that we're facing globally in terms of politics and all kinds of other things about what is real, what is true. We are gathered around the centrality of who Jesus is, and we are brought together in a unity that is special and precious. And the whole picture that is here in these two chapters is of the four beasts. As we said last week, they represent wild and tamed and birds and humans, and the 24 elders, which represent the worshipping community throughout history, and all the angels and every living creature and being, the whole of creation, as you go through the sweep of chapter 4 and 5, is caught up in worshipping God. There is a unity, a unifying sense that worship gathers the whole of creation together. And if we are going to be true worshippers, to worship truly before God is to not waste water while you brush your teeth. Is to be conscious of what damage plastic does to our planet. To be a real worshipper is to understand that we are not separate from everything else, that we are not just isolated in our little bubble of my life and my little circle of friends. but that we are umbilically linked with the whole of creation. And what worship does is it gathers us into this place. And one of the things that is special about worship is that in this room, and there's not a huge number of us, but there are all stripes of political allegiance in here. There are all kinds of feelings and thoughts and things. We are representative, if you like, of a whole basket of humanity and creation. And we need to learn to get on with each other. We need to learn what it means to deal with some of the rough edges that we have. And that's why the proverb that is, I forget which chapter it is now in Proverb, but as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. The idea is that if I am prickly, or you are prickly, not that I move away from you and I cut you off and I distance myself. That's not what worship is. Worship is embracing the people that God puts across our path with all their spiky bits and allowing the relationship to make you closer to who God is and me closer to who God is. And worship gathers us. It brings us into that place. It's a very special thing. There's lots of things I wanted to say this morning, but let's just move on. The third thing is this, that worship reveals, it illuminates. And I was just, while we were singing and worshiping and just thinking of Sunday nights, how many times it happens for me that in the midst of singing and some of the words and thinking about what I'm going to say, the scriptures and that sort of thing, how many times things come into my mind, thoughts come floating up to the surface, people are put in my head. There's a sense in which when we worship, we are open to revelation. We are open to hearing and seeing and learning. And the image that comes right at the beginning of chapter 4 that we saw there was the fact that this throne is like there's color and light. It's like emerald and like jasper. And this is where you can use like a lot, because it's like you can't describe it like. The issue is that you can't really describe what light looks like. There is this radiance, and as it hits stones, it refracts and splits into different colors and becomes more than it actually is, or than we can see. And when we worship, it's as if God shines his light into us, and it refracts and becomes more than what it is if we are not together. And if the light shines, okay, here's, we're taking a slight sidestep. When we worship and Christ reveals himself to us, when we walk out of this place, when we move away from the special place of being alone with God, what should happen is that the light that we've absorbed and received should refract out of us in all sorts of different colors. And do you know what the names of the colors are? This is just for nothing, okay? What are the names of the colors that refract out of us when the light of Christ, who is the light of the world, shines through us? What colors are they? Nope. It's the fruit of the Spirit. So when I worship, I'm placing myself in a way, in a situation where I can be dealt with. The next image there is of a sea. And in the temple, the first thing that you meet in the temple in the Old Testament is the huge laver of cleansing. They cleanse themselves. When Isaiah comes into the presence of God and he sees all the seraphim and the cherubim and all the other things, and they're saying, holy, 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 and their wings are covering their faces. And the whole thing in chapter 6 of Isaiah, his first conscious thing is, I am a man of unclean lips and I live amongst a people of unclean lips. I am not quite like I should be. And God takes the coal from off the altar and touches his lips. In other words, the symbolism is Actually, when we worship, we place ourselves in a place where we are revealed to ourselves. Where we begin to see what we actually are like in the presence of God. And we begin to see our circumstances. And we begin to see those who come in front of us. We begin to discern. We begin to see with God's eyes ourselves and everything around us. And that's what worship does. It opens us up. If we are worshiping, if we are placing Christ at the center, if we are gathering with others who are maybe not like us, but who have a similar intent. So when we are centered, when we are gathered, the first thing that happens is you will begin to have discernment, revelation, illumination, whatever language you want to use. He who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, to this church. The fourth thing is this. Worship sings. And we didn't read those things this morning, but there are five songs in chapter 4 and 5. Go and read them. Some of them are just one verse long. The first one is, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was, who is coming." Three sets of three words in the original Greek. Very, very, very powerful, simple worship. And go and look at them. They worship God as creator. They worship God as redeemer. Different parts of creation are worshiping. And it's just a most magnificent scene of everything being caught up worshiping. And what do? They sing. And part of the reason we sing is because we shouldn't be able to help ourselves when we come and the door is open, the heaven is open, and we see the throne of God. And so if you go back all the way to Moses and Miriam and David and all the way through the whole of the Old Testament into the time when Jesus and his disciples sang, to the time where Paul and Barnabas are in prison and they're singing. Singing is integral because it's a way of communally combining our words, and they mix together and we sing. But as I said earlier on, our whole life should sing. And we sang a song that kind of said that earlier in the worship. That God's song undoes us and we then become a song that other people can see and hear. Let's end off with this. The last verse in chapter 5 ends with the whole of creation, everything, saying one word. It's a word of affirmation. And we've come to, it's become a liturgical word that is kind of meaningless. It has, in a way, become the way we punctuate our prayers to let everybody know that we've come to the end of what we were saying. And we say, amen. But that does no justice to what comes at the end of chapter 5. You know what does more justice to it? Is when you're watching Wimbledon and it's been a long five-set game and these two titans of tennis have slugged it out for about 3.5 hours. And the intensity of the confrontation and the moment and that last point goes in and he goes, yes! There's a sense of absolutely everything in his being is expressing, and he says, yes. That's what this is. Is when we come to a place where we have seen the majesty of God, all the light show of heaven, and all his light shines on us, and we place him central, and we rub shoulders with all the funny who's who of the church. Because it is essentially a really licorice all sort. And we sing, sometimes flat, sometimes in harmony, whatever it is, we come. And we come to the end of that. You know that song that we sang in the 80s? You shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills will break forth. You remember? Some of you older people? What's happening here is that we don't go out thinking, oh good, that's over for another week. We go out with a sense of, yeah! Do you know what? The best thing in the whole world, guys, and this is unreservedly I say this, the best thing in the whole world is to be a follower of Jesus. Why are we so on the back foot? Why do we think that we have to be so PC? Why are we so down in the mouth? Why are we so timid and shy? And we all have our moments. But what worship does is it says, remember who you are. It's a two-way affirmation. It's God saying, yes, these are my people. I love these people unreservedly. There's nothing here that I don't love. And it's a way of us saying, yeah, to God. He found me. I'm His. I belong to Him. This is the best thing in the whole world. There's nothing like it. That's worship. You want to make God's heart glad? Yes, we need to come together like this. There's no substitute for this. But you want to make His heart glad? Then let your life sing. Let the whole of your being say, yeah, I belong to Him. He's mine. I'm His. And we go out with joy. That's worship. This is not dull. This is not gray. This is not have to do. This is the core essence of who we are. And John is saying to the churches of Asia Minor, of Western Turkey, he's saying, guys, get this right and nothing will stop you. All the other stuff that comes along now, which we're going to look at over the next couple of weeks, all falls into place when we know who Jesus is in chapter 1, when we understand who we are as the church, and we get on and worship the way we ought to worship.